city lights lay out before. Your arms felt nice wrapped around my shoulder, and I had a feeling that I belonged. I had a feeling I could be someone, be someone, be someone.
Hello, I'm delighted that you joined us for the fourth in our summit series, virtual conference series. As I said last week, GSV Ventures is open for business. And so I'm excited to announce today that we are the co-lead in a $4.25 million investment, seed investment in Quillbot. As the name implies, Quillbot is a writing platform driven by artificial intelligence. Artificial intelligence, we think, is going to be transformational in the future of learning. And the race is over. English is won. There's now 2 billion people learning to speak English around the world. In China, to graduate from high school, you have to be proficient in English. By the way, that's not true in the United States, but I digress. So Quillbot has got 1 million people on the platform writing using this AI technology. And what we think that really is about is accelerating the learning of how to write proficient English. So we're very excited about that. I also want to make an announcement for next week. For the fifth in the series, we have former Florida Governor Jeb Bush at the same bat time, same bat channel for the next week, Wednesday. And then on Thursday, April 30th, we're having a special edition of the GSV Virtual Series. It's going to be at 4 p.m. Pacific time, 11 p.m. Greenwich time, with ASU President Michael Crow is the special guest, and I'll be interviewing him. We also have another guest, which we haven't announced, but I'll give you a little clue. It will be at 7 a.m. Friday morning China time in that time zone. So with no further ado, I'm excited to kick off as moderator for our first panel, The Future of Digital Learning, with different guests, if you can bring them up. We've got Sarah Allen, who's Deputy Director at the Gates Foundation in Seattle. We have John Caspin, the founder and CEO of Noodle. We have Dan Rosenzweig, the CEO of Chegg. And we have Mitchell Stevens, who's a faculty chair of the Education Enterprise at Stanford Graduate School for Education. So welcome to you. If you can bring everybody out.
Thanks, Michael. Delighted to be here.
Thank you. Maybe just to kick things off, maybe we could just go around the group. And it's been such a unusual time, and it's been so challenging in so many respects. But one thing that, you know, I found anyway, is this kind of shelter in place has also had some unexpected benefits. I'd just like to go around to everybody on kind of a more human level. What's been a positive thing that's happened in this environment that we've been in? I'll kick off and give you a second to think about it. You know, for me, it's just like everything is, despite being on Zoom calls all day, I mean, it's the longest time I've never been on an airplane. And recognizing like things that you have in your backyard, like trees. Think of this is like amazing, these trees and other things. You just start really kind of paying attention to things. And that is a benefit that I don't think we've gotten if we wouldn't have been stuck in the shelter in place. So anyway, I'm just gonna go around real quickly here. If there's any sort of a positive surprise or unexpected benefit that people have received during this period. Start with you, Dan, if you could. And by the way, tell us where you're zooming in from.
Dan, you're muted.
Which is a common.
Okay, I'm now
muted is a common thing that we're hearing in many Zoom calls. Well,
please, I have learned about Zoom backgrounds where all the people that I Zoom with in my company all have Dan mute, so I'm used to muting. I would say that Mike. First of all, thanks everybody for joining. I'm in Montauk, New York. I'm with my wife. My daughters, 26 and 24, both their boyfriends. So that has been fascinating. And, you know, I think that what this has highlighted for the Rosenzweig family is sort of three things. One, gratitude and empathy. Whatever we're feeling, there is nothing compared to what the world is going through and most people are going through. And so we have a limit your complaints to yourself rule, because we're sitting in a beautiful home, families all together. Thank God everybody's healthy. I have learned what it's like to have potential son-in-laws, and I'll leave that to a non-recorded video. And the other thing is, I have gained a greater appreciation for family, because like you, Mike, I've been married 32 years and I've never spent six straight weeks with my family ever. I'm grateful for the opportunity to spend it with my daughters and their boyfriends and my wife. And turns out after 32 years, who knew she was as awesome as she always told me she was. So that's what I've learned.
That's great. Sarah.
Hi, everyone. I'm joining you here from Seattle, and I have been, I counted recently, we got sent home pretty early in this mix, and so I'm on day 48 of being at home, working from home, and having the kids at home. So yeah, with my three kids, two of whom are high school seniors, so it's been a pretty sad spring for them, and my husband and our puppy. I would say one thing that's been kind of amazing here in Seattle is that we have had the most beautiful weather since the beginning of March. It has been sunny. The flowers are blooming. It's just been stunning. And I don't know whether the earth is just taking a breath with less traffic and less pollution. And it's just been unbelievably beautiful here. Today is our first day of sort of cloudy, rainy weather in as long as I can remember now at being at home. So that's been a real gift to get just outside and walk around and be able to just appreciate the beauty of the Pacific Northwest with sun shining down in April, which never happens. And I think the other thing, I won't repeat what I just said, which has resonated, but just I like many of you, have found time to actually connect with people in meaningful ways that I just don't normally take the time to connect to. College roommates, old friends, family around the globe. Using Zoom and other tools in ways that has just felt super meaningful. And I hope that is something, that habit that continues, that we all keep doing even when we get back to our normal rhythms of life. So that's been something I've been really grateful for as well.
That's well said. Mitchell.
Hello, everyone. Nice to see some familiar faces and meet some new ones. I'm sitting in Palo Alto, California. Two thoughts, I guess. One is the very powerful sort of 19th century overtones of this moment. We are walking and looking at things and playing board games and amused and enjoying what are typically very modest pleasures in our hectic world. And the other is, crazy enough, as a college professor, I actually have time to think and write in the last 6 weeks, which are in strangely in scarce supply much of the academic year. So that's an unexpected and very welcome gift.
That's wonderful. John.
Well, happy March 53rd. I'm enjoying myself here with my family, my kids and wife and dogs. I now know what I look like in a hostage video, so that's great. and you know, on a professional level, this is a moment where people are discovering what good online education might look like and what terrible online education looks like. Mm-hmm. And the, you know, forgetting the human suffering, and you can't forget it, but putting it aside for a moment, the intellectual challenge of running a school that's agile and thinking through, you know, what are the benefits and costs? What are the ways that we want to move forward? What does education look like over the next couple decades? Has been fascinating.
Yeah. Well, let's get into that. So I think this really has been a catalyst, obviously, to see what the future might be. I mean, we're saying effectively, we've seen the future get accelerated to the present. But let's talk about higher education, and then we want to bring it to all online learning in a second. But, you know, you've got the last 40 years, you've had tuition at at 3x inflation, you have $1.5 trillion in student debt. Has the coronavirus, do you think, been a catalyst to kind of accelerate changes that needed to take place anyway in terms of a cost, a value proposition, and just how we think about, you know, creating value and a return on investment for college students? I mean, Dan, you at Chegg, you're focused on, you know, you've done an amazing job of really focusing on the student and some of the kind of absurdity that's taken place in terms of, you know, the debt that's been burdened on them and how you really help them be successful and productive. How do you think of this coronavirus as a catalyst or not for what needs to happen in higher education?
Well, I think overall, I think every, you know, I sit on a lot of different boards, Adobe's board and Rent the Runway. So I'm on the extremes of small companies who need cash and large companies who have tons of cash. And then what we're doing at Chegg. And what seems to be clear consistently is trends that were already happening are being accelerated by this crisis. And the question strategically that we're asking is which ones end and which ones don't end. And online education is not going to end. If you just do the math, 10% of US college students are international students. They're not coming back, not anytime soon. Two is about 20% of all students are already questioning whether or not they want to go back in the fall if it's a physical presence. Third is, take California as the largest state. They are already mandating that all summer schools are online, so there'll be no physical presence, at least for their community colleges. And I don't think most people realize there's 2.25 million people in 115 different community colleges in the state of California alone. That's over 10% of all students in this country. And then you look at what SNHU, who I think has been an incredible leader in online learning, just announced, which is they recognize that people are going to be out of work. Most of the people that take online classes today are older. They have jobs. They might have lost those jobs. And that they just announced that they're lowering their tuition. They're ending on-campus enrollments going forward. And I think it's just an example of what's beginning to happen. And I can't talk about Chegg in particular because we have earnings on May 4th, but what I can say is there is a clear, significant acceleration for the need for low-cost, online, on-demand learning tools in ways that I didn't even realize the market was that big. And so I believe that, and no offense to Stanford, no offense to Harvard, but the fact that schools with $26 billion endowments and $41 billion endowments are taking government money and lowering payroll tells you everything that's wrong with the way higher education thinks about who their customers are and what their assets are.
So this will be like a presidential debate. If you use another person's name, they get to respond. Mitchell, go ahead.
I think Dan's right on target there, actually. What fascinates me is that the, you know, the sector has been in transformation for 25 years now. And I would imagine most of the people on this call recognize that and have participated in shaping that. There are a handful of extraordinarily wealthy, exceptionally prominent institutions that that by virtue of their wealth and prestige and institutional position have essentially been able to shield themselves from those changes. Sort of brief dalliances and experiments with more democratic forms of learning notwithstanding. I have the privilege and opportunity of working at one of those institutions, and I can tell you that especially since the presidential election of 2016, the sensibility of the leadership of this university, and I see and hear it elsewhere, recognizes at some new level that they can no longer presume that the great privilege that they have enjoyed from the citizens and taxpayers and government agencies of this country go on indefinitely. And so President Bacow at Harvard's many efforts to think about Harvard's new ways in which Harvard could be of service to a wider range of working Americans, I think, is an excellent example of that. The leadership of my university will rolling out some new public discourse in the coming months. So I agree with Dan, actually, that that ongoing sort of secular change in the character of American politics, plus a moment now when business as usual is simply no longer possible in Cambridge or Palo Alto or Ann Arbor or New Haven, is going to create opportunities, shall we say, for collaborative action that haven't been possible in the past.
Mike, I want to correct something that you said. Higher ed costs, higher ed tuition, net tuition, what students actually pay, has been flat to inflation for 20 years, right? It's the same as it was in 2000.
You should have said cost.
Well, I'm saying that what students are actually paying is the same relative to inflation. What you've seen is schools jacking up their sticker price every year by a couple points over inflation and then giving it back to less advantaged kids. They're simply price segmenting. And when the airlines do it, they advertise their least expensive seat, back when there were airlines. And when schools do it, they continue to talk about their stated tuition and they continue to get beat up over it. So I just want to, we do have a problem. We do need to cut the cost of higher ed. But A, schools have been holding the line pretty successfully, despite decreasing subsidies from the state, for 20 years now.
Yeah, but the outcome of that is completely unfair, which is we have $1.6 trillion in debt. 44 million Americans have it. 40% of them are not paying it, right? This is only going to exacerbate it. So, and most of these schools, even the state schools, label themselves, even ASU wants to label themselves as a research institution. Students are paying to subsidize things that they're not getting the benefit of as a learner. They can't get into classes when they want it. And there's all sorts of other classes that get jacked up around food costs and dorm rooms and all sorts of other things. The education has brought down the cost of everything else on the planet, with the exception of higher education. And so we see the complete opposite going on. So, I mean, the data will say what the data is going to say. But if you look at the outcomes, if you look at the debt, if you look at people being able to finance that debt, if you look at the taxpayer paying it in every conceivable way and look at the result, I don't think we can give anybody a passing grade.
I'm not being an apologist, but again, I have to disagree. Number one, we've simply cut the cost, cut the subsidy of education from 75% paid by the government to 25% paid by the government. We now consider higher ed to be a private good, not a public good. And we're shocked that debt is being racked up. This is money normally we would have paid, and we're doing it at the same time as we've been encouraging more kids of color and more disadvantaged kids to go to college, which has been a good thing, and they are benefiting from it. And the data, and I'm sorry, I'm a data guy, the data says college is still a great deal. So the idea, A, of encouraging disadvantaged kids to go to college, which is good, B, no longer paying for it, but then wondering where the money should come from, is disingenuous.
Well, I would say this, and I'll turn it over to Sarah. Wait, there's a data point, which is more people of color and disadvantage have gone to college, but fewer of them have actually graduated. There's a higher percentage of them that have gone, racked up debt, and didn't get a degree. 43% of people who went didn't get a degree. So yes, more people have come, but it has not advantaged them. And I'll stop talking because we'll let Sarah go.
Well, I want to get Sarah in the conversation, but we can also take a vote later or not if we're going to pay the ransom for John and his hostage video. and I do want to get back to that. I also will give a plug for Noodle. On Noodle's site, there is a great tool that you can go and compare different universities and how money is spent and so forth. It's a very, I think it's very illuminating. Sarah. So I want to talk about, I mean, one of the key focuses that you have at Gates is the accelerating learning and different ways that can be accomplished both with technology and strategies. Talk about, one, what that means, and also how this environment, we say, you know, we've gone from BC before Corona to now we're going to AD after Z. How has this environment changed that, helped it, accelerated it? I'd love to get your you know, I asked you a bunch of things, but maybe you could first describe what kind of what you're doing with this accelerated learning focus.
Yeah, sure. I'll let you guys keep duking it out on the higher ed front and maybe come in and talk a little bit about the pre-K to high school to college space here. You know, I think if you look at the data, again, around outcomes for young people in middle and high school and even early elementary, we have, you know, significant numbers of students who are below grade level, who are, you know, being left year on year with unfinished learning against what we know is the level that is needed to ultimately be successful in a post-secondary environment. So, you know, this is not a new problem. And, you know, there's been a lot of effort going on in the last 15, 20 years to think about models that can really support students to make up those, you know, to find a pathway through the content to get to the grade level. And, you know, we at Others and you have been looking at, you know, personalized learning, ways to support teachers to really differentiate, to meet each kid where they are and move them to where they need to go. And I think that the environment we're in now is really an opportunity where, you know, it's just showing in stark relief how this crisis is going to play out for different groups of kids. Teachers, as they're shifting to trying to do remote learning, are, you know, really feeling the need to take a much more student-centered approach. I mean, you can't do a one-size-fits-all regular classroom delivery in this environment and really meet the needs of kids, and that's just so obvious. So all that to say, I think there's, you know, some shifts going on that will help us accelerate, you know, how the system is able to respond to the individual needs of students through, you know, student-centered approaches to how content gets delivered, how interactions happen with teachers, how interactions happen with other students. There are, you know, some really promising models in the tutoring space that have been plugging into schools but have been experimenting with blended models. One of the ones that I think is most promising is Saga Innovations in Chicago, where they are, you know, really demonstrating massive catch-up ability around ninth grade math for young people, just really outstanding results. And, you know, they've been experimenting with a blended model over the last year that's less reliant on individual face-to-face tutoring and getting as good results. So, you know, there's a lot of promising stuff out there. And I think what's going to shift now is the urgency around actually trying to use it, because we're going to see in the data tremendous differential impacts of this crisis on different groups of kids that are just going to, you know, going to cause us to have to double down on this focus on helping kids catch up. So, you know, that's the upside if we're able to really find the resources and time and structures to really push those acceleration models into the regular school environment in new kinds of ways, creative ways. I think we're going to see a lot of experimentation around that over the next year and a half.
Yeah. Michael, can I make a contribution there?
Please.
I appreciate what Sarah said. One of the things I've noticed consistently over the last 10 years is there are a lot of phrases that begin with, quote, there are a lot of promising models, or this is a very promising, or I'm especially interested in this, or we have incomparable data to understand that. Compared to all of the promises and ambitions, I see remarkably little systematic science. I think it is high time for this sector to frankly grow up a little bit and recognize that we have a very paltry empirical science of teaching and learning and building an infrastructure to do a systematic science of teaching and learning is going to require a collective effort that involves different kinds of capital sources, new ways of doing academic business. And, you know, there are two or three pretty good universities out there that you know, frankly, don't need your money, but their scientists do, right? And we're open for business. We are eager to collaborate and cooperate with this sector trying to find some important new ways in which infrastructure might be built to build a systematic science, maybe with some help from Sacramento and Washington and Lansing. I'm not gonna bet on it. I'd be very eager to work with many people who I'm sure are on this call to use this moment to start to get serious about doing some systematic cumulative science together.
Yeah, you wrote a great article. It was in the New York Times, I don't know, a month or so ago. And there's some different concepts that were floated that were I thought were you know, very intriguing. One thought is just this whole idea of, you know, the mixing up of, you know, you think today you go to a university and, you know, again, conventionally, you graduate from high school as a freshman, you go and you live in the dorm, you pay, you know, a boatload of money for 4 years, then you're supposed to get out, even though most students don't graduate in 4 years. And one of the things that you talked about is maybe sort of a hybrid approach of, you know, mixing things up online, maybe as a freshman where you're paying less money and you're still living at home, some other programs maybe abroad. How do you, what if you sort of reimagine what an experience could be where you were getting the benefit of learning and getting knowledge and skills and so forth that can allow you to be successful in life, but maybe doesn't cost $250,000 and go into, you know, debt for the rest of your life. Mitchell, what are some of the ideas that you think could evolve here, and the coronavirus could be a catalyst to change the way things are
doing? Yeah, terrific question. I would say two things. One is I think this provides potentially a powerful opportunity for the traditional clients of the Rolls-Royce version of higher education to recognize that what they're paying for is not happening in college classrooms, right? It's everything else where the real cost center is. Like moving your kid from Miami to Syracuse and feeding her four times a day and making sure she stays out of trouble on Saturday night is where the money goes, right? It doesn't go to the classroom instruction. And there's been an active reluctance, I think, for both families and schools to parse that value proposition, right? But this moment is making it painfully obvious to families, right? Are they going to pay the same tuition to George Washington University last year for their son to sit at the kitchen table in Tallahassee, right? For an incomparable product. So I think this may force a powerful wedge between the teaching and learning part and the everything else part on the Rolls-Royce model that might enable us to start thinking about comparing apples to apples in a more systematic way. And I also think to the extent that it may change the most affluent families' presumptions about what's the best thing for their 17 and a half year old, I think may also, you know, propel a more receptivity to more plural or heterogeneous kinds of academic experiences. Frankly, I think in addition to the science, I think that's one way where the Southern New Hampshires and the Stanfords of the world might be able to engage in what once was thought of as an audacious collaboration, right? That the icebergs have broken up a little bit now in ways that create new possibilities for new collaboration.
Well, I would want to jump in there and encourage you all to think about the connectivity down to K-12 in this moment as well. I mean, we have not only an economic need, but we also have an educational need for many, many students, not the ones that were heading to Stanford, but millions of others, to have a much more supported pathway between high school and college, to make the transition successfully, to have it linked to opportunities to earn income at the same time, to have a path to sort of stack credentials over a longer period of time to ultimately get to that BA. And, you know, we have a very well studied, actually, set of early college high schools that have been rigorously studied that we know have had really differential effects on the ability of young people to make those successful transitions to stay on those paths. And those have, you know, experimentation in the last few years around really integrating the career element into some of those or creating new hybrid models that are really the earn and learn. And it's, you know, even though this is a moment where formerly affluent families may have to make these tough trade-offs, millions of middle class and lower middle class families have been choosing these other kinds of paths for economic reasons and for social and other reasons for a long time. So, you know, I think it is a moment where the connectivity between high school and college and work and new kinds of models is really ripe, particularly because of the tremendous risk to, you know, millions of 18 to 22 year olds right now, that they will not, they will not be able to follow the traditional path, that the other kinds of paths may look like dead ends. And, you know, it will take a collective effort to really scale up some of these very, very, you know, very promising, but actually fairly well studied hybrid models for when college starts, how it starts, how you progress, how it links to career and other certifications, and ultimately to the degree. So that's I think, where an area we all need to lean in on in thinking about how to support innovation and ongoing scaling up of things that are actually working for kids.
Sarah, quickly name names, if you could, in terms of some programs that you see as sort of a window to that future and doing a great job.
Well, yeah, I mean, I think the traditional early college model that got started in the small schools movement about 15 years ago, and where, you know, that was something that now has a 15-year trajectory. And I would point to, for example, the RGV area in Texas, where they, through South Texas Community College and the set of school districts there, they've created a set of very successful early college high schools that link to particular career paths, whether they're teaching, medicine, others. ultimately making their way now into the UTRGV, higher ed institutions there. So there are places that have been on these models for a while and have seen improvements in the trajectories of young people. And then there's the PTECs and others of the world that have emerged more on the employer-driven front to solve talent challenges that also have created sort of scalable ways for employers, high schools and higher ed institutions to collaborate to create new kinds of pathways. And then we're seeing maybe lighter touch things coming out of the charter sector, 13th year models, where, you know, they are the charter movement, which has been so successful in getting so many kids higher quality charters through high school and into college, but then seeing their data show up that many of those students aren't completing. So they've been experimenting in this space for a while too, and I think are seeing the opportunity now with the economic challenges to, you know, create more space for that and to create a playing field where it feels okay to choose that as your path, that it's not lower status, that it gets you where you need to go. And that's a narrative change that I think we're going to start to see, to your point, Mike, being one of those things that many parents start to value as equally practical and good than the traditional path.
Great.
Mike, in terms of K-12, I look at the higher ed response. Within weeks, every school was online. Give it a C-, right? They're not great online learners, and most of the professors have never taught before. There are all sorts of problems, but they're in the game. Whereas K-12, the great majority of districts have just punted at this point. They've just given up. We've proposed to a bunch of states to take the tech providers we work with in higher ed and the tech platform we very painstakingly put together to work with our schools. And all of us are willing to give it to K-12 at cost to create, in a sense, an emergency virtual classroom. Can we, at a state level, since the districts are struggling, can the state step in with something that's competent? But the starting point of the kind of transformation everybody's looking for is just to move towards agility, is just to move towards, we have a great online infrastructure. It makes sense. Everybody knows how to use it. We can go online when we need to. We can go on campus when we need to. And once we can move between them seamlessly, a lot of the kind of things that Sarah, you're talking about, and Mitch, you're talking about, are possible. The starting point is just to get everybody comfortable both ways. And that's where I think we are accelerating in higher ed, and K-12, not so much so far.
Well, first of all, that's a very generous offer to make for K-12. And we have a number of K-12 leaders on the Zoom call today. And so thank you for making that. And I think we've seen that kind of round the clock support that, you know, by other people in the community. I mean, I know Class Dojo and Remind are incredibly busy and working round the clock to help with the different issues. I want to talk about, and I'm going to give this first to Dan, but I'd like everybody to give their perspective. So in this world where increasingly for sure more and more is going to be done digitally. And online learning is going to be really become the norm of how people consume most of their education. I think increasingly, and again, we could debate about this, but I think increasingly the physical experience becomes more and more of a luxury good, like going to Cartier or to, you know, to a high-end boutique. We could argue about that. But what are the resources, Dan, that you need that are digitally that maybe are more important? What are some of the things that you're providing? What are some of the things that you think are going to be critical for students to thrive in this increasingly digital environment? And get the hold of John. It's John J. Katzman at noodle.com, just because I know that some of you like to reach him about his help. But Dan, how does this look like? What are some of the resources? What are some of the skills? What are the things you think that students really need to be successful? I know you know you're doing a number of things, including internships there and so forth. What does this look like?
Well, look, we have our lamps, right? So we're direct to student. We've not raised prices in 10 years on anything we offer. We invest $50 million a year in content. We don't work with any institutions currently directly because the bureaucracy, I mean, we're trying to give 100,000 free Chegg studies, which is about $3 million worth of educational tools to the state of California community college students, and can't find an entry in because everybody says it's someone else's job and they can't force people to do this. We're like, you know what? Use them, don't use them. We don't care at this point. It's shocking to me. What I will say is, like every other thing that we do, like Zoom is doing here, education for the masses needs to be able to scale. One-on-one classroom learning would be amazing. My mom was a public school teacher in first and second grade for 39 years. My mother-in-law was the dean at our high schools. I have nothing against that. However, when you look at the demographics of the United States, when you look at the average age of a student is now 25, when you look at the average age of an online learner is a woman in her 30s who's trying to improve her profession, cannot leave her home or her work because she has children and a job. So I'm not dealing with the K-12 issues because we play in that in the writing space, and we have about 30 million users in the writing space that help them. But what we see is, in order to scale, things need to be on demand. They need to be contextually relevant and personalized, which means they need to be able to localize to that person's level, whatever level they're entering at. They need to be localized for language. So many people, by 2022, 25% of all college students, English will actually be their second language in this country. We have a different country than a homogeneous countries around the world. So we need to recognize cost, personalization of coming in at the level that you need, the different ways that people learn. Anybody that has more than one child knows they learn differently. So we can teach by text. We have 30,000 videos. We have 35 million questions already asked and answers. We have 70,000 experts in our network. Our tutoring business is 50 cents a minute. It's grown by 4,000% in the last 3 weeks. Numbers that we've never seen before, because what we think is that in order to learn at a distance, in order to learn where you're not going to the classroom, you need a support system that acknowledges the level you're at versus the level in which the school thinks you're at. Not everybody who goes into if you look at ASU, they accept people who got a B across the board at any level. So some people come from wealthy households and have access to things. Some people come from households that don't have any parents. Technology should be able to lower the cost, make it on demand, make it contextually relevant. And we believe, and one of the reasons we bought Thinkful, was we believe we need to accelerate the path from learning to earning. Increasingly, American families are looking for the necessary academics to make them successful in the workplace, but also for skills-based learning. So what we're doing with Thinkful is, honestly, we just offered $1.5 million in scholarships because we're dealing with people who say, I just lost my job. I've just been furloughed. I'm graduating and my job offer was rescinded. How do I get a skill that's employable? So we haven't announced it yet, but we plan to lower our prices in half because otherwise, and increase our ISAs, because the world we deal with is huge, not the small people, the 4,000 people that go to Harvard.
Awesome. Mitchell.
Yes.
What's your view?
Yeah, I want to just, you know, harken back briefly to the exchange that Dan and John made at the beginning about, we can talk about the cost of educational provision, and I'm not talking about just post-secondary provision now, but I think there's a different conversation that I think very rarely happens in my world, in here I am, the zip code that I'm sitting in, and I think also in the ed tech space, which is whose responsibility is the cost of educational provision, right? Is that the government's job? Is that a family's job? Is that VC's job? Is it the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation's job? Like, ultimately, how are we going to carve up responsibility for paying for educational provision, even if we could agree on how much it should cost? And I think one of the fascinating, challenging, spectacular things about educational provision in the United States is that it's always been a plural venture. It's always been a joint venture, partly civic, partly philanthropic, partly a business. And the relationship among those parties is changing now, and it's causing a great deal of controversy among educators especially. I think the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, frankly, has been a model civic actor here because they've taken a lot of heat from conventional educators by their embrace of for-profit models. But the fact of the matter is, I think we're going to have some very serious conversations about the relationship between public, private, and philanthropic capital going forward. I actually am old-fashioned enough to think that some institutions that we created in the 20th century, like research universities, might be places to help broker those relationships in new ways. Because Stanford, for example, is also simultaneously a business and a civic project. And we have relationships across these sectors and a certain kind of trust, frankly, that other institutions don't. And so I think the kind of tensions about cost and provision really need to be brokered kind of head on going forward in a way that I don't think as educators we've really tackled explicitly.
Yeah, I think this conversation could go on for another hour just on that alone. I think it's, you know, in terms of these new alliances and ways that different skill sets and resources get brought together to come up with the radically new solution that really can help accomplish some of the needs and problems and objectives. I want to go to John Katzman with, so from the institution standpoint, this new environment that we're in, increasingly digital, what are you seeing from the, in addition to working with Noodle, what do you see some of the best institutions doing preparing and providing value, you know, in this increasingly digital world?
I think the effort to reduce costs, and particularly the thoughtfulness of our schools in how they collaborate at scale. Universities have traditionally done collaborations of one sort or another, but all very small. And that before we get to the point where Mitchell is, where we all can collaborate, can we get higher ed collaborating in different kinds of ways? And here's an example. You've got, on the one hand, this professor putting together her course bespoke, right? An online course, and it's 100 hours of work. It's tens of thousands of dollars of cost with an instructional designer. We've got to do a ton of that before September. And on the other hand, you've got courseware, somebody saying, well, we're just going to have one Econ 101 course and everybody can just be a TA. But in between, the idea of sharing objects, of this animation, this case study, this simulation, how do we share the costs, maybe share it with schools that aren't competitive with us, maybe share it with less advantaged schools. How do we think about working together to collectively make it easier to build online resources and less expensive? So I see a ton of that being done, and I see a really good faith effort to take the cost out of higher ed. And Mitchell's right. Only about 20% of the cost of higher ed is faculty teaching, and research largely pays for itself. It's everything else that we should be using technology to lower. How do we do that? How do we benchmark with each other? How do we share resources with each other? in ways that they get the outcomes we're looking for.
We're rapidly running out of time, so I've got one last question that I'd like each of you to give your perspective on. I mean, there's obviously all sorts of challenges, all sorts of uncertainties in the environment that we're in today and as we look ahead. But if you were to paint a positive scenario about what can happen here with this overall aspiration of having everybody have an equal opportunity to participate in the future, with the foundation of that being access to quality education, how can this world of, you know, digital learning become what it, you know, what the potential is by increasing access, lowering the cost? And importantly, you know, what can be done, what is being done, and how can it actually also improve the quality to actually be a better experience than what people got from the traditional physical experience? Mm-hmm. And maybe I'll give that to Mitchell first, because you popped up on the screen.
Lucky me. So I would say, sociologists like to say that wars and calamities change reality, because they force people to do to solve new problems that they didn't know they had, and they make defaulting to normal not possible. And if you look at, on my view, if you look historically at the moments when the United States has substantially expanded capacity and access on the post-secondary side, it's happened in the wake of wars and calamities. The Civil War encouraged Congress to act to create the Morrill Acts for the land-grant universities, which were efforts to weave unity in a conflict-riven nation. The World War II mobilization is what created the spectacular organizational expansion of U.S. higher education, which is the envy of the world. The launch of Sputnik created the National Higher Education Defense Act of 1958, which President Johnson very cannily wove into the War on Poverty program to create the Higher Education Act of 1965, which is the greatest act of post-secondary access the United States has ever seen. And here we are again, right, with another calamity. But we can't wait for Washington to lead this civic action. It might lead that civic action, and we can certainly try to help Washington do that. But I think we're at a moment, I think the existence and scale of ASU-GSV shows how much capacity there is in this sector. But we're going to have to figure out how to work collaboratively to create national opportunity. And what I see now is a kind of happy anarchy, an often happy anarchy, but figuring out how to glue that together into some coherent civic action. That to me is the opportunity.
Awesome. Sarah.
Well, you know, on the K-12 front, I think, you know, just building on some of Mitchell's thoughts, that this is an environment where, you know, there is a tremendous shared problem across all school districts. I mean, if you talk to every superintendent in the entire country, they are talking about the same challenges. And there's an opportunity to really make progress on things that the level of urgency was just not as much there. I'm talking about the digital divide and the tech infrastructure. There's an opportunity really to just take that on and solve it once and for all. And there's momentum around that politically. Through E-Rate and other creative ideas, the private sector is stepping up. I think teachers, you know, if you all want a good boost to your day, go on to Facebook to the Teacher to Teacher digital community and watch the video called We Teach On. And it's, you know, teachers are rising to this challenge and experimenting just in the tremendous commitment to try to serve their kids in ways that are just massive learning opportunities for millions of teachers at the same time. And they're sharing those ideas with each other through digital communities. And they're not going to go back to total business as usual. Well, we will all cheer the day our children can leave our homes and go back to those schools.
Even at 27 and 25.
Exactly. You know, teachers have tried so many new things. They're going to bring some of that back to the day-to-day classroom. They're going to be better at differentiation. And there's an opportunity to really create much more solid platforms and supports to really institutionalize some of those approaches and bring in the solutions that have already proven to be effective. So I think there is, you know, the silver lining here is the commitment to meeting students' needs is as solid or more urgent than ever before. the willingness to experiment on how to do that is again just very, very clear, and the need to make sure that we are not institutionalizing and in fact expanding the tremendous gaps in opportunity and quality facing students in different environments today is just something that we need to hold front and center as we move into this new phase. But the tools and resources and experimentation and ingenuity and innovation are there, and it's a question of how we harness it and just drive forward.
Thank you, Sarah. John?
I think, sometimes it's easier to build a new bridge next to a failing bridge and then kind of move the traffic over to it. As schools do online in halting ways, they're realizing they can double their capacity without building another building and without in any way diluting the quality of the institution or the academic credentials of the students coming in. As the schools that get it grow and improve and cut costs, and I think we can cut the cost of higher ed by about a quarter without screwing it up, the schools that don't get it are really gonna have a problem because, and so on the good side, I see schools dramatically more efficient, more tied into the real world, and more responsive. And on the negative side, or I'm not sure it's a negative side, you probably have more students in fewer institutions when the smoke clears. And all of the predictions that people have been making, Sebastian Thrun years ago, there are going to be 10 universities in the U.S. It's not going to go that way, but this is a moment where we are going to see the schools who get it really break away from the pack.
Awesome. Dan, you got the last word.
Yeah, that's a lot of responsibility because I can pick two paths. I can pick what I think is going to happen, and I can pick what you asked, which is what I hope happens.
Do both. Tell us both.
Well, I'll tell you what I think could happen in the spirit, Mitchell, of what you were saying, which is all those moments in history that you pointed to, the country came together with a common purpose and an objective. And today we have a country, and higher education is no different. Almost every industry is similar to this way, which is what we all do is pick who's our enemy. And so we pick the teacher, we pick the teachers union, we pick the institution, we pick the government, we pick the business, we pick private institutions. We pick a lot of enemies. And I'm hoping what COVID-19 is revealing is there's a lot of ingenuity, there's a lot of creativity, there's a lot of passion, and let's pick the winner, and let's make the winner the student. And so if we go back and say, what this process needs to accomplish what by the end of it, and if we can get significant agreement on what the objective is, we know, for example, that 50% of teachers don't feel it's their responsibility to give students working skills for the first 10 years of their career, but the skills that they need for the next 10 years of their career. We know that 80% of all college students go to school for the purposes of getting a better career, right? So if we could sort of clarify roles, and including the question of who pays, I happen to think that employers should pay. And Chegg is paying off all of its students' employee debt. And we argued and we got something in the first stimulus bill to allow colleges to pay it off without taxing the student as a benefit. I think if we realign and we say, look, we want better educated, better citizens, more civic minded, better prepared for technological skills that are an obligation to live in the future society, whether you want to do that or not want to do that, right? It's you can pick whatever your career path is, but we ought to have legitimate pathways that are on demand, less expensive, tax you less in terms of cost and time, because these are going to be never ending stages of our lives now, right? We are constantly being forced to learn new things in order to be successful, to be in society at this point. And so I think if we could pick a common winner, which is the student, and pick an objective of what's good for this country and try to align things, including how it gets paid for, then I think we can stop the division and try more things, see what works, share it, as John says, and scale it. So I think what technology can do more than anything is show us what's possible. It can expand curriculum without risking the current teacher's career, which they often argue against, right? We can expand and have both academic curriculum, professional curriculum, skills-based curriculum. I mean, when we were growing up, they taught me how to use a calculator. They told me how to write in cursive. I was forced to take a typing class. There are basic skills now that we could be teaching all through that make you just more productive in whatever you choose to do. So I hope we pick a common winner. I hope it's the student. I hope the country rallies around. What do we want the educational system to do? What I think is going to happen in the short term is I think 25% of colleges are going to go bankrupt in the next 12 months. And I think John's right, which is I think the schools that have more resources are going to take well-financed, less prepared students for their schools because 10% of the students were international students, but they paid about 15% of the tuitions. So schools are going to be desperately looking to fix financial gaps. And I do think if we can align corporations acknowledging that we have a responsibility for to pay for that education because we're the beneficiary of it, right? If you can engage that without making the school only about that, I think we have a chance to use technology to lower the cost, increase the curriculum, scale, and teach personalized. Okay, done.
I'm enthusiastic. We've gone over time, but I can't leave without asking you, Dan, one last bonus question. When are you going to be able to see another Bruce Springsteen concert?
Well, tonight they're doing a concert for New Jersey, so I already got it. I have an E Street sign guitar over there. Yeah. I think Bruce will lead us out of all of this. There's exactly. A Bruce line or a Bruce song for everything. But I do want to offer one thing. Mitchell, if you want, Chegg will likely have, by the end of this year, 6 million students that are accessing every piece of content from every textbook in the United States. And we can tell you exactly which content they know well, which ones they don't know well. If you think sharing that data with you and researchers at Stanford could create better curriculum, more personalized learning, we will open it up to you because it's not individual, it's the collective. And we want that research to be used to improve curriculum because we just want what we all want. We just want better opportunities for this country and for the people that grow up here, however they came here.
Thank you.
Anytime.
Awesome. Thank you so much. And now we had in the schedule, we were going to pull you guys and get all of your insights because we went overboard and I want to be respectful of everybody's time. We're just going to ask one question. You can send it to me individually. Maybe we'll send out some poll questions later. And that is who votes that we should release John from his hostage duty? Or
let's take this offline.
Okay, take it offline. Send me an email. I'll send out the results.
Can we turn off our video?
We're going to skip the poll. And now we're going to go on to the next segment. And before I turn over to Deborah and our very special guest, Harvard Business School's Dean Nori. We've got a video I want to run that is the American Dream video. Before you play it, I just want to just a quick introduction to it. Global Silicon Valley stands for this emergence of a trend of the mindset of innovation and entrepreneurship that's made Silicon Valley such a special place going around the world. So Silicon Valley really is a mindset. And we think the American Dream, you know, is really a mindset too. It's not specific to America. It's really this aspiration that doesn't matter who your parents are, where you grew up, where you went to school. But if you had the ambition, you studied hard, you kept your nose clean, you know, anything was possible. That is the American Dream. And so we have a number of very important people, inspiring people in this video. Nitin Nori he sparkles in this video. And I think this video, I think, is especially great to play at this time as a lead-in. I'll also just make the point that while Deborah is interviewing Nitin, this is her first day back from the injured reserve. As many of you know, she broke her jaw a couple weeks ago. So, we'll make sure you give her the support as during that interview as well. But I'll turn it, please roll the video.
I was born in Albuquerque, New Mexico.
I was born in India.
Born in Harlem, living in the South Bronx.
You're talking to a son of an immigrant. My dad came here in 1959.
We probably got water in the taps maybe 8 hours a day.
And in my case, I was going to be the first one in our family to go to college.
When I came to this country, you know, all I wanted was a graduate degree. I didn't imagine what actually could lie on the other side of it.
I was often asked by my foreign counterparts, what year did you graduate from West Point? Or what military school did you go to? And the answer was, aspire to West Point, a young black kid, two immigrant parents who were away every day working in the garment industry. It was unthinkable.
My mom came to the United States from South America, and she came with no money, no degree, no education, and I was able to create a really successful life, and I don't think that it would have been possible in any other country.
I remember I got an opportunity at Facebook to be a software engineer, and I was an engineer at the hottest company in 2008 in Silicon Valley. And 6 months later, I was writing code for this company, this vision.
My grandfather on my mother's side came in 1917 as a 13-year-old. And, you know, two generations later, his grandson is the mayor of the city he decided to make home for himself.
The next decades are going to have untold opportunities, and part of becoming successful in the American dream is finding out which ones work for you and pursuing them.
It's an opportunity to succeed based on your ability, not who your parents were, not your religion, not your race, not where you went to school.
So what really drove me to come to America when I was still in college was the position women held here. They weren't confined to the walls of their home because they were afraid of being raped. And it was a position where women could go out and do ambitious things.
I ultimately think it's something that the sacrifices you do for the next generation, for the ability to do something not only new, but greater than what you inherited yourself, both leaving something behind, but also ensuring through that sacrifice that another generation has a better life.
My definition of an American dream is when things happen to you that you could not dream.
It's not necessarily about like having all of the material resources that you need. If you have the drive to make something happen, it doesn't matter what circumstances you come from, you can make it happen. Like you can rub two sticks together and make something spark.
There are many ways in which people can realize the American dream. By starting on shop floors and working their way up the company. I've seen people who come here and start their own business and realize the American dream that way. But if I had to think about the surest path by which one can get to the American dream, or at least have some capacity to grasp it, it's education.
I mean, for me, the American dream was very real. You know, I realized, I thought I could do anything I wanted to do. And I actually consciously realized that was because I had been given the chance to attain an excellent education.
I also was privileged to go to a public school system, which took me from kindergarten all the way through college. And it was there that I discovered the military, I discovered ROTC, and that's what the City College of New York gave me.
As a kid, I saw that people have purposes, and they have things that they believe in, and they have causes that they fight for. The idea and the intent that things need to be fair, and they need to be of value. And when you think of the American dream, that's what you want. You want equality, you want to have a place where there's a balanced playing field.
So when you think about what it's going to take to ensure that the American dream is a reality for all of our kids, it's going to take, you know, ultimately leveling that playing field.
There's opportunities for you. And it's not just if you're the best basketball player, dancer, or singer. If you have the right stuff, and you've spent your time learning and understanding things, the world, and particularly America, is searching for those leaders with ability, whether it be in business, philanthropy, politics, or the arts.
If we're going to ensure that every kid has access to the American dream, a lot of things need to be done inside of education and outside of education. The good news is it's possible. Like, it's actually possible. We see that through our work every day. but it's going to take a whole lot of people working really hard and really thoughtfully and coming at it from all sorts of different directions.
So to me, when I think of the American dream, I'm constantly reminded of all the tools that you have to have. And what's fascinating to me is that I'm 54 years old and I'm still trying to acquire more tools to be a better citizen, to be a better father, to be a better human being, because I know I have to continue to believe in the American dream.
People aren't going to hold you back for who you are or how you look. And I don't look like any other dean that the school has had in the past. But that doesn't stop people in this country, and that's what makes the American dream so special.
There are two books in life. One is the guest book you signed, and one is the history book. I think a life worth pursuing is one in which you're in the history books. So if you're fortunate enough, use your life to give something back to others.
Wonderful. Let's see. Terrific. Thank you so much. That video makes me smile in every possible way. It is really just terrific. And so I'm Deborah Quazzo, the managing partner of VSC Ventures, and as my partner Michael Moe said before this, I am feeling very blessed to be here. I had a little bit of an accident a couple of weeks ago, some of you guys heard, and I actually fractured my jaw. I didn't break my jaw, I fractured it. Minor difference. And I really just want to start by saying I'm giving a profound thank you. The community, our community of change agents, is an incredible community to be a part of when things are going well. But what I've found consistently throughout the 20 some years I've been working in it is even a better community when things don't go well. So I have been really touched and blessed and feel so good about all the outreach that people have had over the last couple of weeks as I've been sort of coming back from this. It's not quite over yet. I've got a few more months ahead, but at least I can talk. I got my wires taken out so I can talk to Nithin, which was the one thing I was my one goal. I needed to be able to talk to Nithin. So I am totally thrilled to be here hosting this conversation with Nithin Noria, who is truly a remarkable human being and one of my favorite humans in the world. He's been the dean of the Harvard Business School since July of 2010. We actually did that video in 2014, I don't know if you remember. So it's interesting, it's been a good 6 years that's passed since that happened. Nithin actually announced his retirement that was going to be coincident with the end of the school year this year. Unfortunately, the end of the school year is never going to happen, apparently. And so after his incredible 10-year tenure, he agreed that with the outbreak of COVID, he would extend his leadership of HBS through the end of this, what will clearly be a very difficult year. I have enough questions to probably go a couple of hours, but we have a short period of time, so I'll try to fit as much content in as I can. Nithin, let me actually start with that video. And we laugh when we sent the young people from Road Trip Nation out to do it. They were so taken with you that the first cut of the video was basically a Nithin Noria story, and they left everybody else on the cutting room floor. They were so taken with your personal story. But talk about the American dream. How does something like a COVID pandemic impact the availability of the American dream? There's a lot of discussion around equity on the prior panel and really in all the conversations. And you said it's things happen to you that you could not dream, was your quote on the video. So I would just love to kind of get your, 6 years later take on what you think.
So Deborah, first and foremost, thank you for having me. And I am so excited to see you looking well and doing well. So I was worried when I heard that you'd had this accident, but it's great that you're here, and the fact that you did this for me means even that much more to me. So thank you very much. And I'm very grateful to the, seems like 700 participants who are on. I hope I'll prove worthy of your time. So look, I think that this is a moment in which we have already now, since these last 6 years, the confidence that people had that the American dream is alive and well has been shaken. It's been shaken as we have seen inequities of so many kinds emerge. there's a colleague of ours, Rod Chetty, whose work might be familiar to many people who are in this audience, who now finds that, you know, your zip code is a better determinant of what your life prospects are than anything else you might be able to have done in your life. I mean, that's the antithesis of the American dreamer. Like, I didn't grow up in any zip code which was even in America. And here I am sitting as dean of Harvard Business School with the great privilege of being able to talk to all of you. We need to keep these pathways open. And I think as we've seen in COVID-19, these pathways are becoming more structurally unequal. At some level, there was always some inequality, but the inequality came out of individual determinations, right? You felt that, yes, some people might apply themselves harder and some people might not, and that would make a difference about what they could do with the opportunities that America presented. Now it feels like there are some parts of the world where as hard as you try, as much as you might do, you might have no opportunity to be successful. And that kind of structural deep inequity is something that we should be very concerned about, especially as it comes to access to education, right? So you see that. And what worries me right now more than anything else is that will the COVID crisis increase the difficulty that people have of getting access to education? You know, so we're at Harvard Business School, we're lucky, we tend to, actually people may not recognize this, we're a need-blind institution, so we get people from all kinds of socioeconomic backgrounds. But we're already seeing some students who had applied to us to matriculate this fall calling us and saying, my family circumstances have changed so much that I need to work. I can't even afford to take 2 years off to study. And when you look at who's making those calls, they are not all equal, right? I mean, they're coming disproportionately from people from minority communities.
Let's follow that thread for a minute. One of my other, really prior to the pandemic, and perhaps not as acutely felt at Harvard and Stanford, but even felt there, there had been a lot of increasing questioning of the ROI, the value proposition, the opportunity cost of an MBA. And now as we look kind of post-COVID, and to your point earlier, I mean, one, you know, I'm going to apologize, my cat may walk in front of the screen. Can MBA programs, I mean, you know, leadership is more important than ever, and they, you know, and HBS is the bastion of leadership. Are you hopeful that coming out of COVID that Harvard, that HBS can be the sort of the birthplace for some of the initiatives that could actually go right at these, you know, the topics of inequity, the factors of inequity, the things that we are seeing? I think one of the things COVID's done negatively, positively, is actually shine a bright light on inequity of access, particularly around technology. And I think people kind of thought that had been solved in the K-12 system, and it hasn't been at all. So I'm just curious, you know, folding all those pieces in, what do you think the roles of business schools and leading business schools and HBS can be in coming out of this crisis and really trying to address the things that have been so aggressively identified, that COVID has actually caused us to re-identify as being so critical?
So, you know, I was in a call with some of our students. I'm still trying to do these virtual breakfasts at 7 a.m. in the morning, and there were people from all over the world trying to join in. And one thing that people said on the call that made me feel hopeful was that everybody seems in some ways to have been forced in this moment. Even as weirdly we've retreated into the bubbles of our own homes, we have also had our bubbles penetrated by the reality of facing something that we feel we share with the rest of humanity. And so many, many students said that for the first time they've had their perspective quite fundamentally reimagined by virtue of coming out of the bubble that Harvard Business School can sometimes be for a 2-year period, and to get more connected with the realities of the world, and to recognize that they have a role to play in addressing some of the inequities that many of them have thankfully been able to avoid, but they cannot now escape because it's every day in and around them in their neighborhoods. So I hope that this collective moment of being more conscious of the challenges that society faces is one that will have some enduring consequences. I I must confess there's a part of me that worries that, you know, as and when this ends, will we just be so desperate to return to our everyday lives that this will just feel like a blip? And, you know, if you look at the financial crisis, for example, some forms of financial institutions became more prudent, but if you look at how quickly household debt and other kinds of debt returned to pre-financial crisis levels, sometimes I worry that human beings don't learn enough from these moments that could be of benefit for the long run. But I hope in this particular occasion that these questions of structural inequity, which have become so transparent and so painfully transparent, will move us all to do something more enduring.
One of our, obviously our theme here is the dawn of the age of online or digital learning. It's, you know, one of the few silver linings in this tragedy has been for those of us who have been trafficking in innovation around digital learning, the fact that it has really sort of given us a step change of progress in that area. I vividly recall the first time you and I met, which was actually pretty early, I think, into your tenure when you came to my office in Chicago. And it was actually the height of MOOC mania. And you were actually just really beginning to formulate your thoughts around what was first HBX and then HBS Online and both synchronous and asynchronous forms. Today, less, you know, really much less than a decade later, probably really only 5 years later, really, you all, HBS has served over 75,000 students. I would love it if you would talk to those universities out there who have had to do it overnight. You at least had 5 years and some pretty good resources at the time. But even with time, it is a pretty radical transformation. Can you talk about the process, the leadership that was required? Harvard and Harvard Business School is probably not an easy place to change things. And so I'm just curious what it was that, you know, that you saw and the impact it's had. And then also, I think, what impact it's had on the culture at HBS, perhaps. And then I want you to feed that back into the how it helped you all move HBS fully online in 2 weeks or whatever you guys did it in.
So, first, I'll start with a confession. When I first became dean, someone had asked me, what do you think of online education as a replacement for what we do at Harvard Business School, which is famous for the case method and so much intimacy and on our campus. And in my first year, the words that I will regret ever having uttered was not in my lifetime. And, you know, here we are just a decade later. If I had insisted on those words, we would have been in very different shape right now. So thankfully, I came to my senses 2 years into my time when I began to recognize that online learning didn't just have to be a camera on a faculty member. So when it just felt like a substitute for in-person education, I was not very excited. But when I began to see that it could actually be something that was very engaging, this is when social networks started to show us the possibility that people can engage and create very engaging experiences with each other socially. That's when suddenly I said, you know, Harvard Business School better play. We can play, and we should play not just for defensive reasons, but we should play because we can create, if we are being imaginative, just as we were imaginative in inventing the case method, along with the law school many, many years ago, that maybe we can create a different vision of online education that was digital first, if you will, and yet leverage the capabilities that we had. So we made a set of choices that were very different than the MOOCs at the time. We said, you know, we're going to create an asynchronous education in which faculty members have no role to play on an ongoing basis. We're going to have a education in which from the very first day is going to be inductive learning as opposed to a faculty member talking at you. So we're going to give students situations like we do in our case-based classrooms. We're going to give them a little 3-minute caselet, if you will, allow them to talk to each other, find ways of creating real dialogue and engagement amongst participants, that we would charge a little bit as opposed to going free, but at a much lower price point than anything that we had historically thought of at the school, because that would ensure that we had committed learners as opposed to people who were tourists as learners. And we were aiming for 90% of our students to have completion rates as opposed to at that time, 3-4%, which is what used to be at MOOCs. We had to create a completely different team, insulated from the rest of the school. It reported to me, I had to create a budget that was protected. Here we just learned the lessons from our dearly departed colleague, Clay Christensen, who'd always said that you can't do disruptive innovation within the mainstream of the organization. You have to build something that is in a kind of organization in parallel. And, you know, it's exceeded every expectation that we had. We've built education that we're proud of. We have very, very high engagement rates. In fact, our net promoter scores online are almost the same as our net promoter scores in our classroom.
I like the online better myself, yep.
It's been interesting though to see during this COVID moment when we have shifted our entire class as others have online as to what the feeling is. There are some things that people truly miss about being with each other in person. In fact, if anything, my own view of this is that this moment will create simultaneously more demand for things in person and simultaneously more willingness to accept things online. So that may sound like a paradox, but I actually think that that's what's going to happen at both times. But the people who have to deliver something that's in person will have to make sure that it is genuinely special in some sense. And
you had a lot of faculty who had not taught online, right? I mean,
And thank God we had faculty who had taught, because over the spring break, they literally became the coaches for every other faculty member who had not. So we got 120 faculty members to learn how to teach online over one spring break. And we have had, in the last now 5 weeks that we've been teaching, actually stunningly good response by our students and our faculty. So the building a capability in advance of this crisis, we never thought when we were building this capability that this crisis would come upon us. You're never prescient until you find out that you were. So I will take the false credit for being prescient, because I really had no imagination that we would get to this moment, but thank God we had that capability.
So correct me if I'm wrong, you have two daughters at Harvard, is that right?
Both have now graduated. So they college and both have graduated.
They were still there. I read an old article then. So do you have them at home or no?
Both of them are at home. Both are working at home. One was in San Francisco, one was in New York.
How's it going?
I mean, on the one hand, it's really wonderful to have these unexpected reunions with your family, as I'm sure everybody who's on this call must have had that feeling. On the other hand, having four people try to work simultaneously from home and not get in each other's hair is not the easiest thing either. So there are occasional frictions, but by and large, we felt very blessed to have this time together that was very unexpected.
Wonderful. Us too. We've only got three of us, but we all fan out. So on a serious note, you're probably not going to have a lot of folks who feel deep sympathy for Harvard's financial distress. But that having been said, you have been, and as an alum, I get all the communication, have been a member of the BDA as well. You've been very proactive in your communication. You've been very transparent in your communication, really with all constituents, as far as I can tell. And you've been, pretty specific around, revenue, $115 million revenue loss, which I'm sure is just a formative number that you'll continue to develop. And I guess a lot probably also depends on what happens in the fall. Projected deficit of $20 million or so. Would you just talk about the COVID impact on HBS, your approach to leading in the crisis? You obviously had to make that quick decision to stay, for one thing, so that was a quick leadership decision. And what you think recovery looks like at the business school?
So look, again, as you rightly point out, the fact that we are facing economic challenges at this time makes my heart go out to everyone else. So I want to have nobody feel sorry for our business school. But it is just worth recognizing that even institutions like ours are facing, we've never had a deficit in 30 years, and we're going to run a deficit this year, most likely. And as we look at next year, chances are we'll run an even greater deficit next year because we don't think that we'll have, for us, executive education is a very large part of our school in addition to what we do in our MBA programs. And we've had zero people in executive education. So just people might not realize this on this call. We have, in any given year, we educate 10,000 executives.
Majority international too, right?
And 2/3 of them international. And so our forecast for the next year is that if we get to 50% of our total enrollment in the next year, that'll be a good year, right? So we're expecting maybe a 50% decline because we think travel restrictions, density, all manner of things are still going to constrain executive education going forward. So we're doing everything we can to respond to these new economic realities as much as I imagine every organization whose leaders are represented on this call. And at this time, you know, I have been a student of leadership as much as now I get a chance to practice it. That was the field of my research. That's what I taught for many years. So I have been following a set of principles that I once wrote about, which is, you know, you have to start by facing reality. So we knew the week before spring break that if our students all went out on spring break and came back, we'd have a crisis on our hands. So the decision to act early and shut down Harvard University was amongst the first, alongside Stanford, that made the decision to say we're not going to have students return to campus. It was a very painful decision. At that time, half our campus wanted to really come back and the other half didn't. So you had to face reality. So I think the first job is to face reality. The second is to be truthful and transparent throughout. I think people know when you're trying to hide embarrassing details and you just have to be clear with people. I think you have to rely at this time even more on your team. There's a certain sense in which you think that you can do it, but I think you have to really rely much more on decentralized decision-making and leadership. Yet you have to lead visibly. I think this is a time when leaders need to be seen by everyone in their organization. So I have made sure that through communications, through calls like this, I'm as available to every person in the organization. In fact, if anything, I think reaching to the front lines of the organization at a time like this is even more important than it would be otherwise. I think you've got to make hard decisions. For example, we've made the hard decision that we will end up opening in the fall.
You will end up fall. I had not seen that formal. Okay.
Because in some way, shape, or form, and whether that's online or in some other way, we'd have to probably open in the fall. And I think that as you work in the crisis to do whatever you can in the short term, it is very important to still keep your eye on what can you learn that will be useful for the long term. So we have been, in fact,